On September the 15th, the sharpest minds in media, marketing and commerce meet at ATS London. One day of unfiltered, on-stage debate about what's actually working, not just the hype. Leaders from ITV, Index Exchange, The Trade Desk, Dentsu, Starcom and VML discuss the hottest topics facing our industry. ATS London, September 15 at the QE2 Centre. Get your tickets now at events.exchangewire.com/ATS London 2026.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from Exchange Wire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to this week's team edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host, John Still, Exchange Wire's head of content, and I'm thrilled to be joined by two of Exchange Wire's C-suite today. First, COO Lindsay Rountree.
Hello, welcome. Lovely to be here.
Always good to have you.
I feel like I've sat in the seat for a while.
I know. We feel like we're back after a bit of a summer break.
Summer shutdown.
Summer lull.
Not been a shutdown for us at all. But
No, not at all.
No, but fewer team podcasts given holidays.
Yes.
Also joined by Rachel Smith, CEO of Exchange Wire. Rachel, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John. For a second there in the intro, I thought you said we're having a teen podcast this week as opposed to team. And I thought, who's brought the teenagers in? Not us.
That's
certainly not me. We are not in that.
Not quite a bring your child to work day.
Yes.
And frankly, having them at home in the summer holidays is hard enough. So bringing them to work is not in the question.
No, work's respite.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
Well, we have three fairly juicy stories to get into today. We're going to be talking about the ongoing Richard Foster versus WPP case, Apple's data consent rules, and YouTube's new metrics. But let's kick off with, this is a tasty one, Richard Foster versus WPP. The legal fight has escalated between WPP and Richard Foster this week, with WPP asking a New York court to seal parts of this amended $100 million suit that Richard has filed. WPP has called the claims sensationalized and say that he is not a genuine whistleblower, but a disgruntled ex-employee chasing a big payout. The dispute now includes new allegations about a Sony probe into WPP Media's rebate practices in China, which WPP says are irrelevant to Foster's case and were shared to damage client relationships. This one's going to run. Lindsay, I'll come to you to start with. How do you think the case will play out? What does this say about agency practices?
So obviously we spoke about the China case when we were in Singapore with Charlotte McKinley and recorded a few weeks ago. We were over there for ATS. And during that, we also brought up what was going on in the US with Richard Foster. This is now getting very, very messy by all accounts. And I feel like Richard Foster seems to enjoy bringing the mess into the situation. He seems like a bit of a messy character, not to be disparaging. But I think that There's a few things going on here. First and foremost, he feels like he's clearly trying to conflate two things and trying to bolster his argument by bringing the Sony case into his argument. Is my laptop making some noises there? Let's just turn that on mute, shall we? And I think that that's where it's getting a bit confusing, because what his argument was obviously it was a global argument, but he is US based. He was CEO of a US the kind of content motion group, content arm of WPP. Mm. And what has happened in China is a very, very different situation that is genuinely nefarious practices by a number of WPP executives in China. It then prompted Sony to go and do its own analysis and investigation in I think it started in Japan originally, in Japan and China, to look into kind of what they were seeing. And they then uncovered a few things. That's now been brought into... in response to WPP trying to throw the Richard Foster case out of court, he's now responded by adding the Sony case into his case. As far as I'm aware, the two aren't related in almost any way, and he's caused a load of confusion amongst that. And now he's caused WPP to try to seal it. And I read an opinion piece about why they would be doing that. And like, it's a $100 million lawsuit. That's not their concern. Mm. Their concern is the flurry of the brand reputation that's going to happen here is the issue. And their concern is that there'll be a flurry of procurement teams among their biggest clients that will go into wanting to do a similar Sony style audit across all of their activity. And a couple of WPP's clients have come out in support of WPP and said that we've worked with them for years and everything's, you know, everything's good. But that's always dangerous too, because it's always dangerous to come out and support somebody that ends up, that turns out and ending up being exactly what they were purported to be. So any brand that's come out in support of them does have to be quite careful. I'm surprised brands even have, because normally they would just kind of...
Keep the powder dry.
Exactly. So I do think that that's a concern there. What's also interesting is it's continuing to fuel this argument around principal media buying, because it's a rebate economy. It's the rebate economy is the issue, and that's the problem. The China thing and the rebate thing are two separate things. Well, the China thing, well, then they're not, are they?
Well, but, so from what I'd understood, so the case that you guys discussed on the podcast in Singapore with Charlotte was concerning some Group M executives in China being charged with allegations of bribery and fraud.
Yes.
And they were found guilty and convicted. One in particular was given a life sentence, which, you know, is the thing that made us all go, holy shit. Now, what's happened with Sony is that you're absolutely right, that prompted them to then investigate their media buying practices via WPP. So what, you know, effectively do an audit into WPP's media buying practices on the Sony account, where they found a rebate model as well as principal media buying model, and then dug into that in more detail to start asking questions about, well, okay, where did this amount of revenue go? And, you know, how was that attributed to rebates? How was that then reinvested? And there seemed to be a shortfall of several hundred million. And that's, those were the findings. But you're right, that doesn't actually have a direct relationship with the predominant case.
It's just a snowball effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's helping to fuel some suspicion around WPP's media buying practices. And I think the big issue here is that it's not that rebates or principal media buying are illegitimate business practices, it's how that's managed and run and controlled within large organisations. So therefore, the allegations here, on the basis of the Sony probe in China and Richard Foster's perspective is, well, you know, we think that you're undertaking some nefarious activities here, and you're not actually just using rebates and principal media buying as a legitimate business practice. You're using them to skim off a margin and, you know, take money from the client's investment pot.
Yeah.
And, you know, exactly. Obviously WPP is strongly refuting that. But you're right, they're not immediately linked. But it is creating this mess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I suppose as we spoke about before, the issue with what happened in China was it was born out of a model that was able to exist. It's born out of the way that media buying practices exist in China, allowed them to even be able to be in a position to administer this fraudulent activity. And that's where the argument, and I suppose that's where Richard Foster's trying to link, well, that's where the Sony case comes into the Richard Foster case, is the rebate model is allowing, is in and of itself not transparent.
And I think that's the bigger issue, right?
Yeah. And so the big problem here will be the transparency conversation is getting repurposed, reinvigorated across the industry. And there will be brands, there will be procurement teams everywhere that will be demanding audits. And principal media buying, the reason that comes into this, despite the fact that principal media buying in and of itself is not an issue and is actually genuinely kind of quite transparent in the sense of agencies are explaining it as a way to kind of keep their margins fresh, et cetera, et cetera. It's a normalized practice. It's been going on for a while. It's very normalized. It is not in and of itself related to the rebate model in the sense of the way that rebates can be abused. Principal media buying can't be abused. But the argument that still keeps coming up is that it is the seed that is has been planted that could grow into a China type scenario. That's not to say it will do, but that is definitely to say that, as you pointed out, the Sony case did bring it up in their audit as something that they had concerns about, and that will keep coming up, and so it'll need to be justified. I think is what the argument, the problem here is going to be.
And WPP have said that there is potential damage here to its client relationships just through the case existing. No doubt. Like you said, the seed, you know, it needs to do is plant that slightest bit of doubt in large clients' minds about WPP's practices. And it's, you know, there's all sorts of reputational damage could be done here around this. So it's,
If you think back to the A&A report in 2016, and we were over in New York around the time that it came out, and we remember the blowback, we had ATS New York at the time, the blowback was significant in terms of every single brand at that time, you know, and that was obviously a report from a trade body looking into what it deemed to be nefarious practices. Like, it wasn't like any court cases came out, were all thrown out of court, like no charges were ever made, but that one report prompted mass panic among brands. And that was a report looking into things. It wasn't one particular agency being labelled as being dodgy in its practices, which will now force every other agency to have to go, well, we don't do that. Whereas the A&A report, because it was kind of blanket, every agency was able to come together and go, well, this is how we work. They're now having to do that like tenfold because one agency has already been tarnished. And that's going to make it very interesting. And it's not just a problem for WBP. It ultimately becomes a problem for every holdco or every agency. Even indie agencies, like not just holdco models, but every agency will be looked at with a fine tooth comb, because every brand will panic about this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, you know, from a client perspective, it's perfectly understandable that they should want to dig into as much detail as possible behind how their media investment is used, right? And so I think you're right, Lindsay. Actually, this is more of a transparency issue than anything else. I mean, David Foster's pursuit of, you know, a sort of a lawsuit might be a separate matter. He's used whistleblowing as an opportunity to say there are some nefarious practices underway at WPP, which they obviously strongly refute, and so they're in a legal tussle over that. What's at the bottom of this is still a lack of transparency around remuneration models within agencies such that clients can understand them. The economic climate that we're operating in at the moment means that clients will want to get to grips with understanding the economic model behind the entire, you know, advertising value chain, and they should be doing that. It's not unreasonable that large scale organisations like WPP and other holdcos or even other independent agencies that have been around for a long time have got slightly complex remuneration models, because they are, it's an agency. So any sort of consultancy or organisation that relies on individual, you know, project by project retainers from their clients will have agreed an economic model, you know, quite often project by project. So it's not unreasonable that that remuneration model will be complex and get more complex as clients are looking to save as much money possible, and agencies are looking to make as much revenue as possible. But what's beneath all of this is that whatever model you agree between yourselves needs to be fully transparent. And I think there was a period in history in the advertising industry where agencies could get away without needing to do that. Yep. And that's where, as I said earlier on, actually having a rebate pool, using principal media buying, they're not illegitimate business practices. They are legitimate business practices, but they're open to abuse if they are not properly, routinely audited and managed. And if they're not managed internally from a transparency perspective, you know, if you think that you can get away with having a model like that and nobody will really get to see the detail of exactly how you move money around, so that means you might be able to skim off a bit here, skim off a bit there, then you're sorely mistaken. And I think that's going to be the world we're living in from now on. So both of you are right. There's a reputational element that will make clients want to understand in more detail how their agencies are spending their media budgets. But that is perfectly legitimate as far as I can tell. And for too long, agencies have it's probably been a mixture of we've got a complex model and we're trying to make sure we protect our revenue. And also we're super busy and we've got loads of clients. We've got a slightly different arrangement with a few different clients. And it's really hard to be completely transparent about everything all the time. So there's probably a mixture of that going on. But I think, you know, these are the days where people will expect to be able to see everything. So expect to be questioned on every element of investment that you make on behalf of your clients.
Yeah. And that's where, honestly, principal-based media buying comes into its own in terms of being able to show that this is how we do work for you. And this is like, if it's a genuine kind of opt-in like contract whereby the agency is taking on the risk and buying all the media up front on behalf of the brand and the brands, which obviously is very, very helpful for brands of different sizes that haven't got the clout themselves to be able to do that. As long as that's all legitimately legitimate and upfront and in contract, that actually is a great argument to say, yes, look, this is what we're doing, this is how we do it, and this is how we're able to keep giving you what we give you, because the way that we've been remunerated for so long and the way that our models run are very, very complex, and this kind of removes that complexity. Yeah. So it should be, hopefully, it should hold up to scrutiny if it's all been done and arranged correctly.
Yeah.
As should rebate. But rebates are falling out of favour for that very reason, is that they don't hold up quite as well, because you can do the skimming off the top. Mm. Principal media buying, there's less opportunity for that. So it should hold up.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we'll
see.
We will continue keeping an eye on this case, because I imagine there's going to be more twists and turns as we go through. But it has, it does have some wide ranging ramifications for the Holdco model and for, I mean, that's ushering in a new age of transparency, potentially.
Oh, lovely.
We could have hoped.
Isn't that the headline writer?
That's it. Always looking for that little,
yeah,
a little click. Let's move on to Apple, who have been not out of the news in the last few weeks in terms of their data practices. But they have decided to revise their rules on how app developers can use personal data for targeted advertising on iPhones and iPads, concluding a multi-year investigation into the company's practices. Germany's Federal Cartel Office found that Apple's app tracking transparency framework has given its own apps more favourable consent prompts than those of third-party developers, a disparity that potentially violates competition law. This is a story that's run for years. I remember four years ago, because I was at ExchangeWire, but Apple were being fined daily because of the, I think it was dating apps in Holland that they were not allowing in the App Store. But that ended up being a million euro a day fine for Apple until it was changed. But Lindsay, what do you think of this move regarding transparency, data privacy? Is Apple finally getting it?
No, not really. No, this is a very important move in the sense of, I feel like it's important because it shows how regulators are finally thinking. So regulators in Germany have been battling on this for a while, and I think in France and Italy the same battle has been going on as well. They're looking at not just they're finally looking at the messaging and wording of the different things that they weren't really necessarily doing before. I think that makes it very, very interesting. But unfortunately, because it's been rumbling on for so many years, and I remember, like you said, I remember when this first came out, that it was when ATT was first introduced, and it was first pointed out that the ability to use certain messaging was not matched with what Apple can use for their own apps. And that's going to really, really affect people's ability to get opt-in rates. That's been rumbling on for so many years now that opt-in rates are kind of stabilised. Like, it's about 24-25% according to Flurry. That's stabilised since 2022. There's no real, this will not move the needle. There's no way that you're going to download an app tomorrow, and because the wording for the app you download, the non-Apple app you download, has slightly changed, you're going to go, do you know what? I'm going to opt in because you've given me some nice little wording there. It's not going to change anything. It's too little too late on that front. The Apple have lost out on the fact that that their wording can't be favourable versus the other app developers, but it doesn't matter because the damage has been done because they've already had 4 years of favourability they're now not going to get. So it's irrelevant from the Apple perspective, but it's a good thing. I think looking at the positive perspective is a good thing on the regulator perspective, because it shows that regulators can look at different things and unpick different things in terms of wording, in terms of how it compares competitiveness with the big tech companies and the people that are beholden to them, in this case, the app developers. But transparency in data, it will make no difference. There'll be no real difference in those apps getting higher opt-in rates than they did previously. So from that perspective, it's unfortunately rather pointless. I'm happy to bring some positive news to everyone.
Excellent. It's funny when you've been doing this for a number of years and hosting, and the stories seem to repeat sometimes in terms of data and transparency and how big tech is acting. I realise I have a fairly decent number of cliches I use around these stories, which is saber rattling when we're talking about the law enforcement side of things. But one I used to use loads was locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, which seems to fit
very appropriate here.
That's what I thought. Yeah, it's come back around again.
Love it.
Yeah, Rachel, how do you feel about this this case?
So firstly, I really enjoy the name of Germany's competition authority, the Federal Cartel Office, yep. Something like that.
The Bundeskartellamt.
Yes, they actually call it, the people who are responsible for making sure you don't start a little cartel.
Just say how it is.
Exactly. Yeah. I love it. Extremely German. Totally. I think it's just really annoying, actually, how Apple constantly try to use this sort of trope of protecting consumer privacy and upholding consumer control as, some kind of moral crusade, when actually they use it as a, to give them some kind of economic benefit over their competitors. And that's exactly what a competition authority should be looking at. They basically use it for competitive advantage. And that's, in this case, what the regulators in Germany have done, is said, you can't just use the fact that you think that you do privacy better than other people as an excuse to block other people from doing it the way that you do it. Ultimately, the bottom line goal here should be, privacy controls and consumer control. And are you doing that any better than anyone else? No, you're not. So you should just be allowing others to create the same messaging as you've already got in your own, in your own apps. So I concur with Lindsay that actually it won't make a material difference, I think, to opt-in rates. And also it feels like sort of slightly weak remedies. Okay, well, we'll just enable different design and different using of, language phrases and better translation. Actually, what you've done is just given yourself a competitive advantage for 4 or 5 years, and it's taken authorities too long to get to the bottom of it, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, you're right, Lindsay. I mean, they've experienced difficulties in, I think it's Italy and France, where they've incurred something to the tune of 100 billion euros fine. So that's not insignificant, but it's still something that they can clearly weather without too much difficulty, right? Maybe not 100 billion, 100 million, can't remember. Anyway.
It could be either, and it wouldn't matter to them.
Well, exactly, exactly. It feels like whatever it is, it's obviously like, a sort of a side note. So,
150 million euros in March in France, March 2025, and Italy was 115 million in 2025.
There we go. So that really is small, small change, really.
Yeah.
So, I just find it annoying that Apple continually try to use that as an argument, and that people think it somehow stacks up, because regulators don't, and they haven't gotten away with that in any market that's tried to regulate them for anti-competition.
Yeah, so they like to come out and say, well, we think it's fine.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right then.
And I think the other thing is, they still use that strongly associated with their brand. You can trust us. We protect your privacy.
The TV ads, on that note, really annoy me, because they are so, they make out every other company that's trying to get your data in whatever way as being these really, really horrible big bag ogres, like big bag gargoyles, and Apple's here to save the day, and like, our tracking isn't scary. Yeah. Everybody else's tracking is scary.
As though they're not in
the
same
unbelievable
category. Yeah. They're in exactly the same category.
Exactly. So. That is absolutely false advertising, and it really, really boils my blood every time I see one.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think in this case, Germany's cartel office has gotten on top of them. Bad luck, guys.
We're fully behind the cartel office.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to meet some people from that cartel office. They'd be serious characters.
But actually, on the note of the cartel office, though, is it not interesting that when the messaging that Apple were able to use versus the app developers were able to use first came out, Germany's own data protection authorities gave it the okay and said, that's fine. It's absolutely fine. So then why did the cartel office have to come in and basically the competition authority come in and say, actually, we disagree? Like,
I think it was to do with the fact. Yeah, definitely. But I think it was to do with the fact that Apple had said that that other app developers couldn't use the same sorts of wording that they were using for their own apps. And it's like, well, you don't have control over that, actually.
No.
You ought not to have control over that. If you have genuinely in the app store set up a competitive marketplace, then everybody should have access to the same tools that you do.
Completely.
Yeah.
Speaking of Germany, Lindsay, you've got a lovely FC Köln sticker on your Apple Mac.
Yeah, massive FC Köln fan. Yeah. I'm not. I don't know anything about them, apart from the fact that the goat, the lovely goat here, is called Hennes, and he was gifted to FC Köln in the 50s when the team was first created. And
a real goat, an actual
real,
goat.
Yeah. Actual real goat. Oh. So now the goat is the mascot.
Yes, yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
And Hennes is probably no longer with us. How long do goats live?
No, I don't think they live 50 years.
Yeah, okay.
Or indeed 70 years.
Yeah.
So I think he's long gone, unfortunately.
Don't tell the Cologne fans. They think it's the real Hennes every day.
I do think they're still like, they still keep, whoever gifted, I forget who gifted the goat, but I think they still keep gifting
A new
the team
goat.
A goat. Yeah. Yes.
And no doubt a descendant from Hennes.
Of course.
And I was just recently in the area. If you drive around the towns around Cologne, there's loads of people that had just had this thing with big goats on the front of their houses. It's,
I like it.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
It's very intense.
Yeah.
Take it very seriously.
Yeah. I think a goat is a great mascot.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant mascot.
Because, you know, they're useful animals and baby goats are very cute.
Baby goats are very cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adult goats are also cute, but baby goats are
Although
very
I did
cute.
Feed some baby goats in Germany on this same trip, and they clawed at they jumped up onto my shoulder and like with their massive hooves, like pawed at me so much that they caused my arm to bleed, like because they were so desperate for the food. And I put the food on the ground and they're like, no, I don't want it from the ground. I want it from your hand. I'm going to keep doing this. You give me food in your hand. And they're just scratching at me. It was unbelievable.
How is goat yoga possible? I've
they
never
need
been.
My poor
and
daughter
now I wonder.
In the groin, and she doesn't we'll see a goat ever again. They were quite intense.
Oh dear,
didn't know goats could do that, so there you go.
How did you go on holiday and get mauled by the friendliest animal?
I know I asked
only Lindsay
question,
yeah I mean it
only
could,
me.
This, they,
only
they could
Lindsay.
Only happen to
yeah.
you
yeah.
you
yeah.
found
yeah.
the wrong un among the goats.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yes, on to our third story. And YouTube is raising the threshold for new creators and also changing how it counts views. So from February the 1st, YouTube will raise the bar for new creators to begin earning money from ads and subscriptions on their platform, doubling its requirements to 8,000 qualified watch hours over the past year or 20 million qualified shorts views in the last 90 days. Also, starting this week, the platform has changed how it measures views across all YouTube formats. A view now counts as soon as the video starts playing, regardless of how long a user continues watching. However, creator earnings will continue to be based on engaged views and watch hours in YouTube analytics. A couple of big changes, one that's come in immediately. I think the interest in monetization here and how that's going to affect how advertisers get cash in terms of what they're doing on YouTube. Rachel, how do you feel that these new thresholds are keeping pace with the platform's scale? What does it mean for people who are producing content on YouTube?
So I think it's going to have a pretty big impact for content creators of a particular level, right? Mm. So it's interesting that they're making it, you know, they're increasing the thresholds for monetization, but they're also making it sort of easier to get, you know, easier to increase views, but harder to actually get money from those views. So I sort of think that it might have a benefit for people that are at the lower and higher end of the scale. So maybe not at the very low end. So if you're a content creator starting out, you might think, well, I can't necessarily attain those volumes in the early days. It's going to take me a while to get to the point where I can actually monetize this. So maybe I'll go to another channel. But I expect lots of people that are starting out will be thinking about going to a whole range of channels, including particularly possibly some channels that we're not even aware of yet that might have niche audiences or might be particularly popular in certain, you know, geos or something. So I think it's probably people that are a bit up from that, so not brand new content creators, but maybe content creators that have got a bit of a stable pool of content and are kind of, you know, have some regular followers and have been monetizing, but it's kind of like a sideline gig and it's not the main thing they do. And now suddenly to be able to continue monetizing, they're actually going to have to really throw themselves into it, turn that into something a bit more serious and a bit more important. And then I think what YouTube are probably trying to do is make more money out of the high value advertising opportunities and therefore trying to encourage people to go down that route. So effectively saying, if you're a serious content creator, you're not going to need to worry about our volume threshold in terms of interactions and engagements, but you are going to benefit from a better monetization piece of the pie. And also we've got all these other kind of advertising partnerships that you could start considering too. And I think they're doing that because they want to drive higher revenue across the board for the content creators and also for themselves, right? So I think that they're clearly trying to sort of push, because how many content creators must there be on YouTube? Like they're clearly trying to push people to, I think, a different revenue model that's going to benefit them as a platform with the, you know, with the enticement that it will benefit the content creator as well. But I think then there'll be a pool of people that won't think of YouTube as a sort of easy monetization platform anymore because it won't be for them. And so they'll have to look elsewhere. I also think it's quite interesting because no doubt they're experimenting with lots of other different advertise rather than just AdSense and search related advertising. I think they must be experimenting with other partnerships and ad formats, and maybe they're trying to grow that side of their business too. I can't imagine what it's like to run an advertising business on a platform that's almost got infinite content. Like, you know, what do you do? Yeah, what do you do with all of that content, and how do you categorize it, and at what point do you kind of decide this meets the threshold for advertising, quality content, and this doesn't? So, you know, it's part of their strategy, I guess, to try to manage that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that they are. You could argue that it's just an established platform updating its legacy policy, yeah, because it's been that way for so long, and it's grown exponentially. It's grown unbelievable amounts since it's set up this policy of kind of watch hours and et cetera, that now it's just updating it based on how many more creators there are versus when this policy started, in line with their own kind of, you know, they'll have targets of how much revenue they want to, of their revenue they're making, they want to be able to give to creators. This makes sense of that. And on that, I have some numbers about what that would mean to the number of people that qualify. And then for the shorts qualifying pool, so there were 25,975 channels at the old bar. Now it's more than halved, 12,819.
Yeah. So this is it. I mean, you know, in the first instance, I thought, well, isn't this going to reduce revenue for YouTube because it's going to reduce advertising revenue across the board because you'll have all these channels that now no longer qualify. But presumably the strategy is they want to grow revenue overall in the longer term, and I guess they want to, and they're trying to do that by driving those people that are on the cusp of those thresholds or anywhere around those thresholds to further professionalize their efforts,
yes,
right?
Yes. And I get what they're trying to do, I think, because the other flip of that is they are, on the face of it, they're also trying to improve quality control. And obviously AI slop is a huge problem across all of these platforms, not just YouTube. Every platform's getting affected by AI slop. And I think the forward-facing angle of this would be that this would actually help improve, stop so much AI slop getting monetized, because I wonder how much YouTube is paying out on AI slop. Probably a lot of their revenue is going on AI slop. I'd love to know the percentage. I bet it's quite high. So the argument would be that this will actually prioritize quality content creators and remove AI slop getting remunerated. But the problem with AI slop is it's slop that can get generated at such volumes, it's designed to be able to clear volume bars.
Yeah.
So if it's already managed to clear the 4,000 hour volume bar, there's no doubt in my mind
that it can do
that. They won't just increase the volume of production, yeah, to try and clear the new 8,000 hour, yeah, bar. Like, yeah, it will, so I don't think that will have the impact YouTube probably expect it to in terms of helping reduce the remuneration of AI slop. And that does mean, if that is the sole reason of doing it, I don't think it is the sole reason, but if it is a big reason of doing it, it's affecting quality content creators, yep, in the process.
Yep.
Especially, as you mentioned, Rachel, the niche ones that rely on kind of a fewer number of quality viewers, that will never ever hit those thresholds, yep, now can't monetize in the way that they used to.
Yep.
Or if at all. But it does bring it in line with what TikTok are doing. So
yeah,
there is that.
And then it makes me wonder if alternative platforms will pop up if they haven't already. There must be, in other geos, there must be platforms of choice that are different to YouTube in other language markets. And it makes me wonder if, other alternative platforms altogether might pop up for video watching.
Little quiz question for you. Speaking of TikTok,
I do enjoy a quiz question.
Which British celebrity advised people to get rid of TikTok this week to delete it?
Oh God, I've
which
got no
British
idea.
British celebrity advised people to get rid of TikTok. Can we ask questions?
No, let's do a guessing game. Yep.
Oh, I've got no idea.
So yeah, you can ask questions.
Okay.
This is fun.
Were they a reality star?
They are now. Yeah.
They are now.
Okay.
What were they before? A sports person. Sports personality.
No. Comedian. Actor.
No, not quite.
Oh. Not quite an actor. A journalist.
Yep.
Journalist.
Oh, Piers Morgan.
No.
Who's a reality star that's a journalist?
And originally a journalist.
Originally a journalist.
Used to like cars.
Over 50, under 50. Jeremy Clarkson.
Clarkson wasn't fond of you over TikTok.
Features on TikTok. Yeah, wouldn't have thought TikTok cares about that.
I don't think they mind or their followers mind.
His reasons?
Just that it was a time sink. In short, this is going to turn out to be one of these things that I've read that isn't true and is AI slopping itself. Clarkson has said that TikTok
been like
is,
doubly juiced.
Doubly juiced,
wouldn't it?
But no, that was a lovely guessing game. You did
that was
very
quite
well.
Fun, actually.
Glad I threw that in.
Yeah.
Let's make this a feature.
We should. Yeah. The guessing game, the weekly guess, the
random,
weekly quiz.
Random.
But I think it should be question and answer oriented too. So it shouldn't just be exactly like we've done it so that we can ask a few.
Yeah.
Yes.
Guardrail
questions. 20 questions.
Oh, excellent. You heard it here, guys. We'll make this a regular feature.
Lovely.
Excellent. On that note, and with a new regular feature for us, I will leave it there. Lindsay, it's National Dog Day. Happy National Dog Day to our US listeners. Will you be celebrating?
Absolutely. What shall I get my... I might get my dog a woofin.
A woofin? What's a woofin?
It's a dog muffin.
Oh, a woofin.
Dog-friendly muffins. Call them woofins. Or another ridiculous one for cupcakes. Pupcakes, obviously.
A pupcake. Yes. Or a woofin.
Or a woofin.
Yeah.
Puppuccino.
Porsecco.
Oh dear!
Yeah. Wow. Oh, it gets worse.
What's a Prosecco? Just a fizzy drink for a dog?
I don't think
dogs like fizzy drinks, do they?
Chicken
flavored fizzy drink.
I'm not giving it to Sebastian because I think it might kill him. But
definitely. Mm. Well, happy Dog Day to Sebastian and to like you said, all our US listeners. This is only National Dog Day in the US, right?
It is US National Dog Day. I don't know if Britain has one. I will check.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But yeah, and thank you, Rachel, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Happy Wombat Wednesday.
Wombat Wednesday.
And thank you all for listening. That was your Mad Tech Podcast for this week.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.